Kia ora tātou. Thanks, Miranda. Appreciate that. Joe Hollander, I think most of you know me anyway. But it's my pleasure to welcome you all to the first of our evening presentations tonight. We have seven of these this year, and although our numbers are down because it's such a fine night for barbecuing and playing golf and going fishing, but thank you all for turning up. 5 years ago, we commemorated the 75th anniversary of the creation of the United Nations. And we thought, gosh, time flies when you're having fun. This year, it's the 80th anniversary of the creation of the United Nations. And I know we've all got various personal views on the usefulness of such an august body. So I thought we'd invite our resident expert back to tell us a little bit more about the United Nations. So it gives me great pleasure tonight to welcome back Professor Beth Greener, who is Head of School for Planning, Environment and... No, I've got it really the wrong way. People, Environment and Planning. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, good. From the College of Humanities and Social Sciences up at Massey University. So welcome, Beth, and the floor is yours.
Awesome.
Well done.
Joe, it's always lovely to be here. So, tēnā koutou, I'm Beth Greener. My research area has, in the past, predominantly focused on UN peacekeeping operations, both policing and military. And so that's where I've tended to be interested in the workings of the UN. And I look back, I had completely forgotten I had done a presentation 5 years ago, and things were quite different 5 years ago, particularly thinking about the possible futures of the United Nations. So I was actually a little bit depressed coming to this topic 5 years later, particularly in the peace and security realm. So what I've actually done, so I don't go away too depressed, is talk a little bit about some of the shortfalls in that space, but then also draw your attention to the majority of the work that the UN does, which is not in the peace and security space, but rather is in the economic and social space. So, yeah, hopefully we won't be too sad by the time we leave. Okay, so I understand the hesitation around the United Nations. Some see it as a bright light. From my own dealings, I've predominantly dealt with the UN, what was the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, now is Department of Peace Operations, and found people there often to be either amazing, burning the candle at both ends to make the world a better place, or not very nice people at all, self-interested. But nonetheless, the ideals that are embodied in the United Nations are really important. And so I think we do still need it, just to give that away now. And I'll talk to you about some of the reasons why I think we do, or at least something or some version of that. So I've been looking at options for reform in the UN, which are quite limited and have been stalemated for a long time. So, sorry, there's a lot of detail on the slide, but this will be available, I understand, later. Yay. So it's just to remind us of the creation of the UN and why it was created. And obviously, we remember with World War One, the consternation, and I think the moral, the moral weight of that war, particularly in the West, which saw itself as being very civilized, having engaged in things like trench warfare, the way in which that particular conflict unfolded left, particularly Woodrow Wilson, US President, determined to try and initiate some sort of organization to prevent war from happening again, or a war like that from happening again. And so the idea of collective security was kind of mooted at that point. And collective security is very much that idea of all for one and one for all. So rather than defense alliances or defense organizations or coalitions, which are clustered around exclusive groups, this idea is that the institution needed to be inclusive and represent interests as best as possible. One of the shortfalls, though, of the League of Nations that came about out of that particularly horrific war was that it required unanimity. So it required that everybody agree. And when we get lots of people in a room, we have trouble getting everybody to agree, particularly when it comes to vested interests, when it comes to conflict, when it comes to emotion, when it comes to trauma, all sorts of different influences. And another thing that was around at this point in time, though, was also the idea, which has lived on a lot in US foreign policy up until now, is the idea that we need to make the world safe for democracy. That World War I was very much a case of kaisers and czars dragging their unwilling people to war, and that one way to safeguard the future of world peace would be to encourage democracies. There's a lot of literature around this, which proves that, you know, wartime presence is really popular, and that we can be quite, you know, democracies can be quite warlike. But that idea has kind of prevailed, and in a lot of our institutions, including the UN, there is that liberal bent. So despite the fact that the United Nations that came about was represented at the Security Council by very different countries, got the USSR, the USA, Britain, France and China as the permanent five on the Security Council, a lot of those values are still embedded and imbued throughout the UN system. So what we had through in the 1920s was, and into the 1930s, was an effort to use an international organisation to control the excesses of state behaviour. So, and it was successful in some times, right? So the League of Nations successfully negotiated a peace between Greece and Bulgaria in 1925. It settled a number of border disputes. The Permanent Court of Justice was created. There were all sorts of mechanisms being created. But eventually we know that that fell down. You know, when we begin to see Japanese aggression in Manchuria and the Italians in Abyssinia, we begin to see the limits of an organisation when states begin to look after themselves. But one of the key factors of the failure of the League of Nations was the lack of American engagement. Despite having mooted the plan, Wilson was unable to convince the US administration to effectively sign up. So one of the things that just towards the end of World War II, where we've seen a huge number of casualties again, we still see an interest in collective security. So what's really interesting is that all of the powers that came to be those permanent five are interested in this ideal. And that's quite something, right? The League of Nations failed, you've got another massive war, but we'll try again. Now, it's quite significant. And we'll try again as countries that are very, very different. Stalin apparently saw the UN as potentially just something which would help prevent aggression, as experienced with Germany. But it was very much something which was mooted by Truman and, Roosevelt and Churchill. By 1943, there were discussions about this. By 1944, in particular, you're beginning to have some principles being put forward. So in Moscow in 43, there is formal agreement by the USA, USSR, UK and China that there is a need for this new institution, that it should be based on sovereign equality, i.e. states, all states, no matter how big or small, have the same sort of right to exist. And also, they were concerned about not overly taxing the vanquished because of the Treaty of Versailles and what they believed happened off the back of that. So they also said we need collective great power buy-in because the Americans weren't in the first time. We were weak. So we need all those great powers to really be behind this concept. And with great power comes great responsibility, but that's also why they wanted the power of veto in the Security Council, because they believed it would be them having to enact, not only agree to peace efforts or efforts to push back against aggression, but that they would be the boots on the ground. Didn't really happen that way. The idea too was that the new institution should have an enforcement mechanism. The League didn't. There was a lot of talk in the 1930s, and this is quite interesting, I only found this out because I was doing work on policing. In 1933, around then, there was a lot of conversation about a United Nations police force, but by that they meant an air force. So they thought about the League of Nations, the League of Nations looked to the possibility of having an air force to use air power to subdue aggressors. And they didn't pick up on it, but it was mooted. So in coming into 1944, they're like, right, we need to be able to actually use force. We've seen an inability to actually deploy force stopping us from engaging properly in peace enforcement. By 1944, they'd identified the objectives: maintaining international peace and security, developing friendly relations, achieving international cooperation, and coordinating national actions to achieve those ends. By 1945, they've got the UN Charter, which comes into effect on the 24th of October. In the preamble, I'm not going to read all of this, but I wanted to bring in a few key words. One is the emphasis on preventing the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow, and reaffirming faith in fundamental human rights and the dignity and the worth of the human person, and in equal rights, which is interesting at this point in time, 1945, to establish conditions where respect for obligations arising from treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained, and to promote progress and standards of life and larger freedom. So there's a lot of the preamble to the UN Charter is seen as the kind of spirit of the UN Charter. It's why are we trying to achieve this? And so this idea that we establish this international organisation in order to try and live in peace, international peace and security, not to use armed force, and to deploy that machinery for the economic and social advancement of all peoples. So we know what the UN looks like in general terms. Just a really quick reminder, General Assembly is everyone, 193 states. Security Council, Permanent 5, they're now called the P5 and the E10, because we shorten everything to acronyms. So the Permanent 5, as we know, those victors of World War II. The elected 6 in 1962 was the only time the UN system was reformed, when they increased the number of non-permanent members, now they're called elected, to 10. So out of 193 states, you have 15 on the Security Council. And remember, when the UN was created, there were about 50 signatories. So the number of states we have has multiplied significantly. 1947 and 1948 was huge for the explosion of number of new states. Really interesting. There's also the Economic and Social Council, which does a lot of the work of the UN, and the Secretariat, where we've got a Secretary General, currently Antonio Guterres. And they basically are there to kind of be the leadership to identify the agenda, the general direction of the United Nations. So it's empowered effectively to maintain international peace and security, protect human rights, deliver humanitarian aid, promote sustainable development, and to uphold international law. Just very briefly, the General Assembly, when you look at definitions, it literally says it is just that, it's an assembly. None of the resolutions are binding. Security Council resolutions are supposed to be binding upon states, but international lawyers disagree as to how efficacious international law is, because there's no sovereign to make you do it. And that's when the question about should the UN have a standing military or a standing police force really comes into being, is to kind of to create the enforcement mechanisms we might need. A lot of the, we'll talk about some of the economics and social programs. But in this charter, which I happen to have pinned up on my wall, it's a fascinating document if you've not actually had a look before, because again, we think of the times, and these people are trying to future-proof this organisation until evermore in 1945, with these countries, very, very different, very divergent, coming together to create general principles. And it's quite astonishing what it does manage to do. So a number of the chapters are, you can kind of skip over. It's about who gets to be a member, what you have to do, what the agencies are, that sort of thing. The really interesting chapters are Chapter 6 and Chapter 7. So Chapter 6 is about the peaceful settlement of disputes, things like sanctions, economic sanctions, diplomatic censure. Chapter 7 is the possibility to use force. And in particular, there are a number of different aspects in the Charter that have fallen by the wayside. So Article 47 contains the possibility of the Standing Military Council, which does kind of exist at the UN, but it doesn't really have any power. But the idea was that maybe countries would lend their troops to the UN, and they would become UN troops rather than nationally badged, happening to wear a blue beret. So there's some aspects of the UN which never came to fruition. But the most important aspects in the Charter are State sovereignty, yes. There's a lot of emphasis on state sovereignty and the state's right to not be impeded or invaded. But there's also a lot of emphasis in different parts about human rights. And there's also a mention of things like self-determination. So we've got some tension in the Charter about who gets what, where, and how. But the most important article is 51, which is basically the idea that... I'll find it, actually. Might as well read it. I've got the thing. I could summarise, but it's way better. They write it way better than me. That nothing in the Charter, present Charter, shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defence if an armed attack occurs. Until the Security Council has taken measures necessary to maintain international peace and security. So effectively, when members join the UN, they are also saying the Security Council will take that responsibility of maintaining international peace and security. They effectively agree to that principle. But recently, we haven't seen a very good response to some of the challenges of our time. So with regards to Ukraine, most of the world agrees that the Russian invasion was an illegal invasion, that it could be classified effectively as a war, and that it was not necessarily provoked in the sense that the only right to the use of force that you have under the UN Charter is that right to self-defence. So Russia, to some degree, claimed that there was self-defence because they were protecting Russian pro-Russian separatists in the east of Ukraine, in places like Donbass, and they also claimed that the government of Ukraine was dangerous elements, particularly talked about Nazism amongst the Ukrainian government, but that view has not typically been accepted in the international environment. And what's really significant is what happened yesterday. So you'll see the date there, February 24th, 2022. So yesterday, 3 years ago, was when Russia invaded. What was really interesting around that time, I'm not sure if you remember, there'd been this mass mobilisation of Russian forces. There was a lot of intelligence saying this is likely to happen, but there was this suspended disbelief. War won't happen in Europe again. You know, there's conventional war. We are seeing conventional and unconventional and illegal use of, you know, use of cluster munitions, all sorts of other weaponry that we are supposed to have outlawed in Ukraine. So, I'm going to... There we go. So, what's really important about the Ukraine case, that what it shows to us, is that the Security Council, tasked with upholding international peace and security, obviously, there's the power of veto. So whenever countries wanted to bring out resolutions to try and protest the situation in Ukraine, Russia would veto those resolutions. And sometimes... have other members abstain, particularly. China has typically been abstaining. So nothing has got through the Security Council. However, there was a resolution in 1950 which effectively suggested that if the Security Council is not dealing with something very well, then the General Assembly can discuss it. And that's a really interesting... So if the veto has been wielded, it can go drop back to the General Assembly. That's really interesting because most of the time, if something is under discussion by the Security Council, the General Assembly is not allowed to talk about it. It's big stuff with the big kids and not down with the General Assembly. But one thing that the Ukraine conflict has done is it's brought what they call the veto initiative to the fore, which is basically as soon as a veto is applied in the UN Security Council, that particular topic gets pushed back to the General Assembly to debate. And that's been happening since 2022 in the Ukraine situation to quite a significant degree. And what that means then is that the political tone or the title, one, it gets talked about. It doesn't get, oh, there's nothing to see here, which can happen at the UN if the doors get closed in the Security Council. And effectively, in 2022, there were a number of resolutions. One, aggression against, these are the titles, aggression against Ukraine, humanitarian consequences of aggression against Ukraine, suspension of the rights of membership of the Russian Federation and the Human Rights Council, territorial integrity of Ukraine, defending the principles of the Charter of the United Nations, furtherance of remedy and reparation for aggression against Ukraine. Those were all in 2022. So the General Assembly is sending out these messages going, no, not good enough, not good enough, not good enough, not good enough, whilst the UNSC is saying nothing. But again, the General Assembly is an assembly with no enforcement capability. It can't initiate a UN-mandated force. It has to go through the Security Council. And typically what was happening with the General Assembly, so just so that you know, for a resolution to pass in the General Assembly, normally you need half. It's just majority passes. But when an issue is seen as being quite serious, and it's actually literally called, serious initiative? Something really important like that. You need a two-thirds majority. So these are passing with at least two-thirds majority. And typically the numbers are sort of 143 in favour, about 5 against, and about 35 of abstentions. That's the kind of what's happening in the division of the General Assembly. The ones who tend to be against included Russia, Nicaragua, Syria, the DPRK, North Korea, and Belarus. So typically they're the ones who abstained. The ones who voted against. China and India typically abstained, which is quite interesting when you think about China being very careful about what it's doing in this space. What happened yesterday? So if we see, yesterday everything went. For the very first time, the UN Security Council adopted a resolution on Ukraine. But it adopted a toothless piece of paper. So there were two, sorry, I know this is not good for eyesight. So there were two resolutions tabled yesterday because it was the anniversary. So there were two that went forward to the General Assembly, a US-sponsored one and a Ukraine-sponsored one, which had most of the European countries behind it as well. The US-sponsored one was called Path to Peace, and it was limited to basically talking about the loss of life, and it called the conflict Russian Federation-Ukraine conflict. It didn't say Russian aggression. It reiterated that the principal purpose of the UN is to maintain peace and security and to settle disputes, and it urged a lasting peace. That was it. That was a few paragraphs. The Ukraine one was 3 pages long instead. Now, obviously, the one on the left is fairly inoffensive. People kind of agree it's bad. But, so it passed by 93 votes to 8. 73 countries abstained because they weren't sure what they were voting for. You know, are we voting for a weak and wimpy slap on the hand if we say yes? But all of the member states, it only passed when the EU said, we're going to amend your language. So now, in the General Assembly resolution, it mentions full-scale invasion of Ukraine by the Russian Federation. Then it got accepted. It talked about the territorial integrity of Ukraine and called for peace in line with the UN Charter, which is use of force only in self-defense. However, it was the weak, wimpy one that went up to the UN Security Council. So nothing gets done. The Ukraine proposal talked about the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It's persisted, having devastating and long-lasting effects, and that it's basically a threat. This is a kind of cloaked way of saying a threat to international peace and security, because that's when the UN can act. If there's a threat to international peace and security, the UN has the possibility of acting. If it's a domestic matter, it may or may not. It called for a commitment to sovereignty, independence, unity and territorial integrity, and talked about internationally recognised borders, i.e. everyone else can see that border except you, Russia. So it's not legitimate that you've taken. Basically, they had annexed a number of areas, particularly in the east. What's interesting, this is the General Assembly little scorecard, very pretty with its little crosses. The reason why it doesn't add up to 193 states is some countries just don't vote, like aren't there to vote. So it passed by 93 votes to 18 with 65 abstentions. For the very first time, the US voted with Russia. The US voted last night with Russia, North Korea, Belarus. Yeah. So
do the American people know that, though?
That, well, they may not if they're watching Fox. to be frank. Yeah. It depends on what access they've got. And or, I mean, it may well be it could well be presented in a very particular light about this is a making America great again by withdrawing all our commitments and, you know, getting involved in international conflicts, which basically suck us dry. Yeah. So I thought it was really important to twiddle my slides before I came because this wasn't on there last night. But it tells us something about the state of the world right now, obviously. Yeah. So, slightly depressed now. So, let's go to some better things instead. So, we know that the UN does this, you know, the big peace and security things, that this is where things get stymied. However, I think this is a really interesting... One thing that Ukraine has done has, in some ways, increased the importance of the General Assembly, because it's like, right, you guys don't get to just have the say on this thing all the time. It's also about the rest of us who aren't one of those 15. But I think it's also, what it does do is it again shows where the moral kind of weight lies and where the outliers are. And I think that's a really important thing in international affairs, to see kind of where do people think that the right thing to do sits and why. However, the UN is much more than just that peace and security. We'll briefly mention something so we don't go away from here too depressed. So 2024 budget was about $3.59 billion. Sounds like a lot, but it's $1.25 per person for the year. US dollars, so it's probably more like $2. But, so it seems costly. But one of the things I think is really important is we kind of forget that there's a lot of agencies that effectively either keep people alive on a daily basis or provide them with education they wouldn't otherwise have access to. A really good one, I think, is advocating against child marriage. That's a really big project in the UN. So thinking about UNICEF, that's one of the roles that the UNICEF plays. So UNICEF is in most of those countries, I think 190 of the 193. It's there to protect the rights of children. It's proven that there are more children in poverty than adults. Trying to provide education, health, nutrition. It's got the largest provider of vaccines in the world and the largest humanitarian warehouse to respond to children's needs in conflict. You've also got things like the World Food Programme, which is trying to effectively... We know in some ways that we produce enough food, right? It's just we don't distribute it equally in the world. And the World Food Programme attempts to find ways to bring back life to arid areas to respond to major emergencies like famine, flood, but also to engage in kind of longer-term development. And then we've also got UNHCR, which is the refugee agency. So these are three of the big, big beasts that eat a lot of the money in the UN. And they're kind of doing... day to day, these are some of the people I met that are burning the candle, that every day they're wanting to just try and make life better for humanity. And it's now often a bit of an uphill battle, but nonetheless the kind of ideal is there. But there's also a whole raft of other agencies that you might be interested to know about. I haven't put them all up here, but I've circled a couple because the IAEA, the Atomic Agency, is increasingly important. And that's run by the UN. And the reason why that's so important is it is the agency, the only real agency that can safeguard nuclear weapons in particular. And the UN just has been releasing reports about how close we may be to the possibility of another nuclear war. It's also the institution that has gone into Ukraine on the 15th of February after reports of the Russians' drone strikes making holes in the structure over Chernobyl. So they're the ones with that capability. Is that time to hurry up? So there was a drone strike. It hit the dome that covers Chernobyl and the radiation, and they're the agency that goes in to assess. There is no change in radiation. I thought I could say that before we all panic. But nonetheless, really concerned about the fragility of the nuclear safety situation in a military conflict. We've also got UNESCO, which does things like tells us we need to protect and preserve culture and humanity. And I really like that Churchill quote about, you know, kind of the point of war is to preserve things like the arts. You know, human life is more than science or just existing. It's an attempt, you know, it's also about creativity, communication and culture, those sorts of things. And lastly, things like the World Meteorological Organization. It's pretty important. Does a lot in particular of information gathering, sees itself as an objective source for information about climate. So two of the other things which the UN is still really important for are these big global talks about things which are seen as tragedy of the commons. So things which are bigger than individual states' needs, and in particular climate change. So the UN is the one that drives things like the Paris Accords, the various reports that come through, which are increasingly terrifying if you have a look at the recent percentage increases. So, you know, effectively, the ideal of the UN is that it is an institute, it's the only institution where you have all member states, plus about 2,000 NGOs that are accredited, plus a number of territories like Western Sahara that may not be a state, but that have observer status, Palestine as well. It's one of the few organisations where, if, you know, it's kind of, that inclusivity really matters. And they talk about diversity can be a right problem sometimes, but it's also the strength of the UN as well. So you have that those numerous cacophony of voices. And climate is increasingly a challenge that is really only able to be globally met. And I saw Winston Peters saying that if big countries are not in the Paris Accords, why would New Zealand be? Yep. That's a really difficult question, but it is a little bit like somebody's doing shitty behaviour. Should you do shitty behaviour too? No. Plus, also, we're in the Pacific, where so many of our neighbours are seeing sea level rise everywhere. You know, they're existentially threatened. And also things like the Sustainable Development Goals. The SDGs, I'll do a shout-out, because we have the only Master of Sustainable Development Goals in New Zealand, which is a really cool programme. But the MSDGs, what it does, I really like the fact it tries to draw our attention to real basics. So if you've not come across the Sustainable Development Goals, they came out of the Millennium Development Goals and went all the way back to the kind of Earth Summit in Rio. But really the MSDGs are all about... the very first one is zero poverty. It's quite basic stuff. Things like gender equality, things like equality between nations, things like sustainable and clean energy, education, the right to education, those sorts of things. So there are a number of goals, and they're broken down into different kind of component parts that each country is supposed to try and align themselves with. Again, the reporting is not very positive on some of this. But again, if you've got the standard, you can be told off for not being held up to those standards. If you don't have the standard, you don't have the discussion about where should you be. You know, should you be having decent work and economic growth? Well, hopefully. Should you be having peace, justice and strong institutions? Well, hopefully. If these things, we know from working in institutions, if something's not in the strategy, it's very hard to get funding for it. So, you know, when something's written down and becomes a deliverable, like you need to deliver something, then, you know, there's a chance that it will get done. We are seeing a lot of gaps here. Again, it's that kind of tragedy of the commons, lack of ability to enforce. So this is the big thing in international affairs, right? The enforcement gap. The UN can't enforce that countries do climate change emission commitments. They can't enforce the Sustainable Development Goals. They can't enforce peace necessarily. And that is kind of our big issue in international affairs. But as most people say, most people behave pretty well most of the time. You know, if you've got those standards and you can go, well, actually, that's actually not good behaviour, then it's you do at least have the capacity to have some form of pressure, if nothing else, in international affairs. And I guess the last question is always, this gets attributed to like Madeleine Albright, Tony Blair, and then it keeps going backwards and backwards. So I'm not entirely sure who on earth said if we didn't have the UN, we'd need to invent it. Because just simply having a forum, like literally a physical space in particular, in the New York, notably on land gifted by Rockefeller back in the day, so they were right in their boots and all in 1945, the Americans. You know, it is a place where ideas can be created, generated, people could be shamed, lots of finger pointing, but there are questions around it. You know, efficiency, agreed, those sorts of questions. The last couple of administrations have really focused on corruption issues, on downsizing bureaucracy and different bits and pieces. There's often, and it's almost gone the other way, not that long ago, there were 13,000 police in the field and 19 people in New York supposed to be recruiting them, overseeing them, bringing them back and redeploying them. That's a lot of people to be responsible for. So, yeah, it's kind of gone the other way, almost the bureaucracy. But, yeah. So I think, yes, we still do need it. The other thing, reason why I think we still do need it, I don't have the quote, but ironically, the American and British leaders of the day brought the, you know, were really keen on the idea of the United Nations because, most importantly, they wanted to stamp out authoritarianism, totalitarianism, and fascism. So we'll see if that kind of comes up again in the UN in the next few days, given that Trump has refused to call Putin a dictator as of this morning. Awesome. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Beth. We've got plenty of time for questions and challenges.
Oh no.
So, questions and challenges.
Yeah.
Running away.
Trump's idea of defunding all sorts of things, is that impacting on the United Nations?
Yep. I mean, the US has always been a bit naughty about not paying its dues. One of the few times that it actually, so every member state is supposed to pay dues. It used to be on your GDP, but also on your reparations you were supposed to pay after the war, so that kind of died down eventually. But it's very much on GDP, and the US has been the biggest economy. So it was supposed to be the biggest funder. It would get behind on paying the UN when it wasn't doing what it wanted. It finally paid its dues up properly in 2003, which is when it wanted a mandate for the war against Iraq. So, there hasn't been a lot of funding coming from the US anyway, but I suspect, I mean, a lot of the programs that the US engages with are often alongside, if not kind of in cohort with some of the UN agencies like USAID. That is hitting hard already. A number of, you know, programs, you know, doling out vaccines or food have just been cut straight away. So we're seeing that immediately on the ground.
Yeah. What about the challenge that he's given to the World Health Organization pulling out of that?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's a fairly large...
Yeah, that's huge.
Scary.
Well, it's really interesting... Oh, that's a very blasé way of saying it. But pulling all funding from health research is an astounding decision, particularly in an era where we increasingly do have, you know, viral threats developing and emerging. Again, it's one of those things where these are collective bodies, but the UN is only as good as its member states, right? It's only as good as the members' willingness to actually engage, pay their dues, send the right people with the right equipment on missions, things like that. So I guess, yeah, what will probably happen is you'll see like-minded states begin to operate outside the UN, and that's been a theme in Republican administrations for a while. So McCain campaigned on leaving the UN, and joining a League of Democracies, creating a League of Democracies. So it's been there for a while, yeah.
What are the majority of the members of the United Nations get rid of the veto? I mean, Helen Clark is trying to work on that. Why don't they get rid of where you have 99.99 people, organisations say, don't do it, and yet one can veto it and the whole thing just dust?
It's absolutely insane, isn't it? So when, I mean, we know when they were signing the charter back in 45, the New Zealand and Australian representatives campaigned really hard for there to be no veto. But the myth goes, I'm not sure if it's true or not, that there was literally a draft on the table that the Americans threatened to tear up if they didn't have it. Because they believed, again, that they would be the ones being the main funders and they would be the main... people, they would make the decisions, and then it would also force them to engage in enforcing those decisions. in the kind of peace, just because I happen to know, in the peacekeeping space, throughout in the early 2000s, it was predominantly Western European countries that were engaged in peacekeeping, and that very quickly tilted. And now troop-contributing countries and police-contributing countries are typically from the global south. The West is unwilling to put boots on the ground. In New Zealand, we've seen a huge drop in our peacekeeping commitments. The scene is too dangerous, particularly in missions like in Congo. But in terms of reform, there's been a number of attempts to reform the UN. Oh, wow. So the closest was 2005, when it was after the war against Iraq, and everyone was like, whoa, that was bad. And the UN, what happened there? So Kofi Annan basically got countries to try and vote on two different plans to expand the Security Council, to do away with the power of veto. And really, the best idea, I thought, was to give the great powers parts of the veto. So you'd get a third of a veto, and you'd have to find some friends. You know, that sort of thing, so that, sure, richer countries may have more of a say, but it's not going to block things entirely. And that's why it's really interesting to see China abstaining, actually, because if you have vested interests, countries aren't supposed to veto. They do anyway, obviously. So that didn't get anywhere, and that was probably the best moment in time, you know, just after the war against Iraq, where the US went without really full, you know, there was no UN mandate. And the UN then had to help in reconstruction. So it's kind of like, hey, quid pro quo, why don't we have a talk about these powers that you have? China claims it will give up its veto power if others do. So it's been very careful about putting that out on the table early. And has been quite a loud supporter of expanding the council as well. Again, it gives China quite a lot of soft diplomacy gain in developing countries in particular. But reform requires quite... I've got it written down here because I thought, how on earth do we get out of this? Just check where did I put it? I'm pretty sure it requires unanimity amongst the P5.
Hell will freeze over.
Yeah, pretty much. There's a really good paper brought out earlier this year about non-reform, like are there other things you can do? And they're wondering about the General Assembly becoming a vehicle. Because the General Assembly also, during the Balkan crisis with Kosovo, the Russians were vetoing the possibility of military action by the UN. NATO went ahead and did airstrikes in Kosovo anyway, and then later got a UN approval. So people are wondering, we're thinking maybe that would be a model that, because the General Assembly was calling for action. So it's like, okay, so if if most people are saying this isn't wrong, we should do something, then if you do something and then against the Security Council, that'll be okay later. And that's what they were trying to do in Iraq as well.
I suppose the MFO is another example. Of a non... UN.
Yeah, and most peacekeeping missions recently have been non-UN, so
yeah,
Ramsey.
Yeah.
They're operating often with a man, because the UN does have its capacity to subcontract these things to regional organisations. So that it's been a UN, African Union often cooperate in Africa. There's different problems with different options.
Do you see NATO becoming like a toothless beast that the United Nations is?
See, NATO's
a very expensive, toothless beast.
Yeah, NATO's a strange one because NATO obviously has the Americans in and the Europeans.
Well, at the moment.
Countries have left before. Spain's popped in and out. France has popped in and out. They can leave. Article 5 is very much the NATO kind of core, which is threat against a NATO member. And the only time it's been actioned was for Afghanistan, which is very strange. NATO has increasingly been operating out of area. I don't know if NATO will be the conduit. So the issue is often that in the military operations that NATO has been involved in the past, it's been American command and control, basically. I think Europe is squirming right now. And they've talked for years about a European Union Ready Reaction Force of 15,000. So there's been conversations, they've been, you know, there's been in Brussels, they've kind of considered this. They've got the Eurogendarme, which is 5,000 base effective gendarme police that they deploy, that they deployed to Afghanistan. So they've kind of got some experience. NATO, without the US, the whole idea is to keep the US in, the Russians out, and the Germans down, right?
It's interesting reading papers of Sir Anthony Eden on the subject of the European army post-World War II.
Well, the French, the French particularly, were often quite interested in the possibility of driving something for Europe. And maybe it'll be really after the conversations in, it was Munich, wasn't it? I think there'll be a lot of interest in actually having serious conversations about, is it going to be a European Union force, because NATO may not be the vehicle for it.
Any other questions?
Are there many Nazis in Ukraine?
I don't know.
I was having lunch with two friends at lunchtime today. And they were saying that it's Ukraine and Nazis, that's a Russian around the right.
Whether it's National Socialism or whether it's far right.
There's a huge
excuse.
There was a huge far right movement, although what's really important, of course, is that it's not the majority. So even with the German elections, still most people are like saying, no, this is not for us. And when you look at the map, actually, of the German elections, it's East Germany. So not quite sure, where and how that's spreading. But I do know in the UK, it tends to be in the more impoverished, that you see reform. So there's all of these different connections. In terms of that question, I think there are, far right people. But the Russian propaganda system is a real thing. We get hit massively with bots in New Zealand. We know we do, with a huge amount of misinformation.
We could go and help if a force goes, a beast force goes into over there. We have a good chance that we might go and help, right?
Yeah, I mean, there has been talk last week about a peacekeeping force. We have been involved in quite a significant degree in training the Ukrainians in the UK, and in sending a lot of logistical help in particular. What more can we do in the current state of things? That will be interesting.
You said a lot about Ukraine, nothing about the Middle East.
Yeah, I was choosing my topic.
Yeah, I thought you might.
I mean, it's... you almost don't know where to start. That's a pretty horrific situation. And it is one that has divided the Security Council. It's also really interesting to see the dynamics playing out within the United States right now. When you have Elon Musk... He is giving a Nazi salute. How does that play in that dynamic? So there's a huge amount in there. I have no doubt that there should have, that there was, the initial assault on the Israelis was not legal, should have had a response, but it has gone too far.
Antonio Guterres was... doing a speech this morning, New Zealand time, against operations in the West Bank. Now, whether you call what he said was misinformation, was very close. Taking sides, basically.
And that's a big call for a... this is why I'll be interested to see if there's mention of things like fascism. Because the United Nations, though, although it kind of talks about being... It presents itself as being neutral. As I said, it's imbued with that liberalism in the sense that there was a fund, there is a fund for democracy. A lot of countries in the UN aren't democratic. So, and the World Bank and the IMF have tended to kind of require democratic transition or consolidation for funding.
But also the big political groupings, for example, there's the issue of, say, Chinese influence in the Pacific, and is that influencing votes? And say, I mean, one thing that said, talking about the Middle East, the number of Muslim countries who are likely to vote one way and so on. So is that, when you say we need something like the UN and how much say should it have, is that a limitation?
Yeah, I mean, again, that question of how diverse it is really, you know, that, again, that's the reason for the UN, but also hugely, you know, problematic. You can't get five people in the room and get an agreement, let alone 193 countries. But one thing that has been apparent in the UN General Assembly up until the last couple of years has been a massive split between developed and developing countries. And I think some of these conflicts, like Gaza, like Ukraine, are seeing more of a conversation between different people because, yeah, there is commonality in terms of the concerns that are there. But a number of those concerns are also not being heard, you know, strong enough. So I think particularly around climate change, because it's the developing countries that are typically taking the hit, whilst the developed countries continue to pollute.
Yeah, question over there. No. New Zealand's been involved one way or another in the United Nations operations, depending on whether you call them peacekeeping or keeping the peace or whatever, since around 1948. But it would be interesting a show of hands here, because I know personally there are a number who've been on UN operations. But just a show of hands in amongst the group here today.
Yes, that's with the
Ramsey.
Korean.
So the police, the armed forces, you know, the armed forces.
Yeah, I can remember. I wasn't going to say it, but earlier days in World War II, my parents and others talking about the League of Nations, more or less blaming it for World War II occurring, and later on, as being a young person, I've just done compulsory military training. I volunteered, but at the back of my mind was about I'm doing my bit to help United Nations be a success.
Yeah.
And I was jokingly going to say something for you had up there. Do we need it? Yes, Lydia Ko as a sportswoman of the year. Your career is marvellous. Though we used to sing a ditty about Sigmund Rhee, which wasn't very nice. Nor do you think we'd come here to eat your rice.
I'm really surprised about how much love there is for New Zealand in Korea. It is overwhelming.
Yes.
And many other countries.
It's embarrassing.
Yeah, it is a little.
The things that they offer me.
Activities
and others.
1948 was Pakistan. After the separation of India and Pakistan got established. I think that was our first 1948.
Yeah.
And
Cyprus followed pretty soon.
Yeah, Cyprus was sort of on the coattails of the UK, but nevertheless, there's been a lot of activity since that time. But not only peacekeeping and keeping the peace, demining.
Yeah, that's huge.
At one stage, New Zealand was the leader in UNIMAS, mine action.
You might be interested to know, and what is hotting up as a conversation. I was just at the Peace and Disarmament meeting last week. There's a lot of a conversation about the demining in the Pacific, particularly that is still there, and it's still a need to ramp up.
I mean, you know, you're talking about Ramsey, but
all the
unexploded World War II unexploded ordnance that's still floating around the Pacific Islands.
Crazy.
World War II.
And also another thing that came up was the question about the veterans who were on the ships that sailed out to watch the nuclear.
Yeah,
yeah. You know, it's only just starting to be addressed now.
On the other side of it, through UNESCO and IDP, we've also had a number of engineers, New Zealand combat engineers, who were involved. You remember Mike, what's his name, who went up to Bhutan,
Bridge building.
Yeah, great. Believe it.
Yeah.
Believe it or not.
Yeah.
So there's been a lot, you know, quite a lot of activity behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Not that I'm very proud of it, but I was dragged in to a delegation that went to the Soviet Union before they busted up in 1990.
I'd be pretty proud of that. That's kind of interesting. That would be fascinating.
Yeah, well, not now with what they're doing.
No, true.
We were
always preferable. Yeah.
3-month-long technical delegation to try and sort out energy issues and nuclear generated electricity and such like. And a couple of other disasters like the Aral Sea and what have you.
It was a huge effort at the end of the Cold War, wasn't it, to go in and tie everything up?
It was interesting in having to go back to New York and do all the debriefs. That was just another...
You met some of the not-so-good people?
Yes. Not-so-good, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's for another time. No other questions for Beth. I think we're probably better to bring it to a close. So, once again, grateful thanks, Beth. We'll get you back every 5 years.
I'll try and remember I did it 5 years ago next time.
Well, actually, your first presentation is up online. It's on the website. So, if you missed the 75th anniversary,
It was more positive back then.
But it is, it is a really important topic, and it's something that we shouldn't lose sight of. So my thanks to Beth for bringing us that update. So a round of applause.